Part 7. Chapter 1. Levins had been in Moscow for more than 2 months. The date had long passed on which, according to the most trustworthy calculations of people learned in such matters, Kitty should have been confined. But she was still about, and there was nothing to show that her time was any nearer than it was 2 months before. The doctor, the midwife, and Dolly and her mother, and most of all Levin, who couldn't think of the approaching event without terror, began to be impatient and uneasy. Kitty was the only person who felt perfectly calm and happy. She was distinctly conscious now of the birth of a new feeling of love for the future child, for her to some extent actually existing already, and she surrendered blissfully to this feeling. The child was no longer only a part of her, but sometimes lived his own life independently of her. Often this gave her pain, but at the same time, her strange new joy made her wish to laugh. All the people she loved were with her, and all was so good to her, so attentively caring for her, so entirely pleasant was everything presented to her, that if she hadn't known, and felt that it must all soon be over, she couldn't have wished for a better and pleasanter life. The only thing that spoiled the charm of this manner of life was that her husband was not here as she loved him to be, and as he was in the country. She liked his serene, friendly, and hospitable manner in the country. In town, he seemed continually uneasy and on his guard, as though he was afraid someone would be rude to him, and still more to her. At home, in the country, knowing himself distinctly to be in his right place, he was never in haste to be off elsewhere. He was never unoccupied. Here, in town, he was in a continual hurry, as though afraid of missing something, and yet he had nothing to do. And she felt sorry for him. To others, she knew, he didn't appear an object of pity. On the contrary, when Kitty looked at him in society, as one sometimes looks at those one loves, trying to see him as if he were a stranger, so as to catch the impression he made on others, she saw with a panic even of jealous fear that he was far from being a pitiable figure, that he was very attractive with his fine breeding, his rather old-fashioned reserved courtesy with women, his powerful figure, and striking, as she thought, and expressive face. But she saw him not from without, but from within. She saw that here he wasn't himself. That was the only way she could define his condition to herself. Sometimes she inwardly reproached him for his inability to live in town. Sometimes she recognized that it was really hard for him to order his life here so that he could be satisfied with it. What, indeed, had he to do? He didn't care for cards. He didn't go to a club. Spending time with jovial gentlemen of Oblonsky's type, she knew now what that meant, drinking and going somewhere after drinking. She couldn't think without horror of where men went on such occasions. Was he to go into society? But she knew he could find satisfaction in that only if he took pleasure in the closeness of young women, and that she couldn't wish for. Should he stay at home with her, her mother, and her sisters? But much as she liked and enjoyed their conversations for ever on the same subjects, Alinya Nadinya, as the old prince called the sisters' talks, she knew it must bore him. What was there left for him to do? To go on writing his book he had indeed attempted, and at first he used to go to the library and make extracts and look up references. But, as he told her, the more he did nothing, the less time he had to do anything. And besides, he complained that he had talked too much about his book here, and that consequently all his ideas about it were muddled and had lost their interest for him. One advantage in this town life was that quarrels hardly ever happened between them. Whether it was that their situations were different, or that they had both become more careful and sensible in that respect, they had no quarrels in Moscow from jealousy, which they had so dreaded when they moved from the country. One event, an event of great importance to both from that point of view, did indeed happen. That was Kitty's meeting with Vronsky. The old princess Maria Borisovna, Kitty's godmother, who'd always been very fond of her, had insisted on seeing her. Kitty, though she didn't go into society at all on account of her condition, went with her father to see the venerable old lady, and there met Vronsky. The only thing Kitty could reproach herself for at this meeting was that at the instant when she recognized in his civilian dress the features once so familiar to her, her breath failed her, the blood rushed to her heart, and a vivid blush, she felt it, overspread her face. But this lasted only a few seconds. Before her father, who purposely began talking in a loud voice to Vronsky, had finished, she was perfectly ready to look at Vronsky, to speak to him if necessary, exactly as she spoke to Princess Maria Borisovna, and more than that, to do so in such a way that everything to the faintest intonation and smile would have been approved by her husband, whose unseen presence she seemed to feel about her at that instant. She said a few words to him, even smiled serenely at his joke about the elections, which he called our parliament. She had to smile to show she understood the joke. But she turned away immediately to Princess Maria Borisovna, and didn't once glance at him till he got up to go. Then she looked at him, but evidently only because it would be impolite not to look at a man when he's saying goodbye. She was grateful to her father for saying nothing to her about their meeting Vronsky, but she saw by his special warmth to her after the visit during their usual walk that he was pleased with her. She was pleased with herself. She hadn't expected she would have had the power, while keeping somewhere at the bottom of her heart all the memories of her old feeling for Vronsky, not only to seem, but to be perfectly indifferent and composed with him. Levin flushed a great deal more than she when she told him she had met Vronsky at Princess Maria Borisovna's. It was very hard for her to tell him this, but still harder to go on speaking of the details of the meeting, as he didn't question her, but simply gazed at her with a frown. "I'm very sorry you weren't there," she said. "Not that you weren't in the room. I could have been so natural in your presence. I'm blushing now much more, much more," she said, blushing till the tears came into her eyes. "But I'm sorry you couldn't have observed through a crack." The truthful eyes told Levin that she was satisfied with herself, and in spite of her blushing, he was quickly reassured and began questioning her, which was all she wanted. When he had heard everything, even to the detail that for the first second she couldn't help flushing, but that afterwards she was just as natural and as much at her ease as with any chance acquaintance, Levin was quite happy again, and said that he was glad of it, and wouldn't now behave as stupidly as he had done at the election, but would try the first time he met Vronsky to be as friendly as possible. "It's so wretched to think that there's a man who is almost an enemy, whom it's painful to meet," said Levin. "I'm very, very glad." Chapter 2 "Please, go then and call on the Bowles," Kitty said to her husband when he came in to see her at 11 o'clock before going out. "I know you're dining at the club. Papa put down your name. But what are you going to do in the morning?"
"I'm only going to Katavasov," Levin answered.
"Why so early?"
"He promised to introduce me to Metrov. I wanted to talk to him about my work. He's a distinguished scientific man from Petersburg," said Levin.
"Yes, wasn't it his article you were praising so? Well, and after that?" said Kitty.
"I shall go to the court, perhaps, about my sister's business."
"And the concert?" she queried.
"Why should I go there alone?"
"Oh, yes, do go. There are going to be some new things there. You used to be so interested. I would certainly go."
"Well, anyway, I shall come home before dinner," he said, looking at his watch.
"Put on your frock coat so that you can go straight to call on Countess Bohl."
"But is it absolutely necessary?"
"Oh, absolutely. He's been to see us. Come, what is it? You go in, sit down, talk for 5 minutes of the weather, get up and go away."
"Oh, you wouldn't believe it. I've got so out of touch with all this, it makes me feel positively ashamed. It's such a horrible thing to do. A complete outsider walks in, sits down, stays on with nothing to do, wastes their time and worries himself and walks away."
Kitty laughed.
"Why, I suppose you used to pay calls before you were married, didn't you?"
"Yes, I did. But I always felt ashamed, and now I'm so out of touch with it, by God. I'd sooner go 2 days running without my dinner than pay this call. One's so ashamed. I feel all the while that they're annoyed, that they're saying, 'What has he come for?'"
"No, they won't. I'll answer for that," said Kitty, looking into his face with a laugh. She took his hand.
"Well, goodbye. Do do go, please.
He was just going out after kissing his wife's hand when she stopped him.
Kostya, do you know I've only 50 rubles left?
Oh, all right. I'll go to the bank and get some. How much?
He said, with the expression of dissatisfaction she knew so well.
No, wait a minute. She held his hand. Let's talk about it. It worries me. I seem to spend nothing unnecessary, but money seems to fly away simply. We don't manage well, somehow.
Oh, it's all right, he said,
with a little cough looking at her from under his brows. That cough she knew well. It was a sign of intense dissatisfaction, not with her, but with himself. He certainly was displeased. Not at so much money being spent, but at being reminded of what he, knowing something was unsatisfactory, wanted to forget.
I have told Sokolov to sell the wheat and to borrow an advance on the mill. We shall have money enough in any case.
Yes, but I'm afraid that altogether...
Oh, it's all right, he repeated. Well, goodbye, darling.
No. I'm really sorry sometimes that I listened to Mama. How nice it would have been in the country. As it is, I'm worrying you all, and we're wasting our money.
Not at all, not at all. Not once since I've been married have I said that things could have been better than they are.
Truly, she said, looking into his eyes.
He had said it without thinking, simply to console her. But when he glanced at her, and saw those sweet, truthful eyes fastened questioningly on him, he repeated it with his whole heart. I'm positively forgetting her, he thought. And he remembered what was before them so soon to come.
Will it be soon? How do you feel? He whispered, taking her two hands. I've so often thought about it that now I don't think about it or know anything about it.
And you're not frightened?
She smiled contemptuously.
Not the least little bit, she said.
Well, if anything happens, I shall be at Katavasov's.
No, nothing will happen, and don't think about it. I'm going for a walk on the boulevard with Papa. We're going to see Dolly. I shall expect you before dinner. Oh, yes. Do you know that Dolly's situation is becoming utterly impossible? She's in debt all round. She hasn't a kopeck. We were talking yesterday with Mama and Arseny. This was her sister's husband, Vov. And we determined to send you with him to talk to Steva. It's really unbearable. One can't speak to Papa about it.
But if you and he...
Why, what can we do? Said Levin. You'll be at Arseny's anyway. Talk to him. He'll tell you what we decided.
Oh, I agree to everything Arseny thinks beforehand. I'll go and see him.
By the way, if I do go to the concert, I'll go with Natalie. Well, goodbye.
On the steps, Levin was stopped by his old servant Kuzma, who had been with him before his marriage, and now looked after their household in town.
Beauty, that was the left shaft horse brought from the country, has been badly shod and is quite lame, he said. What does your honour wish to be done?
During the first part of their stay in Moscow, Levin had used his own horses brought from the country. He had tried to arrange this part of their expenses in the best and cheapest way possible, but it appeared that their own horses came dearer than hired horses, and they still had to hire anyway.
Send for the veterinary. There may be an abrasion.
And for Katerina Alexandrovna? Asked Kuzma.
Levin was no longer struck as he had been at first in Moscow by the fact that to get to Sivtsev Vrazhek, you had to have two powerful horses harnessed to a heavy carriage, to take the carriage less than 1/4 mile through the snowy slush, and to keep it standing there 4 hours, paying 5 rubles for this. Now it seemed quite natural.
Hire a pair for our carriage, he said.
Yes, sir.
And so, simply and easily, thanks to the facilities of town life, Levin settled a question which, in the country, would have called for much personal trouble and exertion. And going out onto the steps, he called a sleigh, sat down, and drove to Nikitsky Street. On the way, he thought no more of money, but mused on the introduction that awaited him to the Petersburg savant, a writer on sociology, and what he would say to him about his book. Only during the first days of his stay in Moscow had Levin been struck by the expenditure, strange to one living in the country, unproductive but inevitable, that was expected of him on every side. But by now he'd grown used to it. That had happened to him in this matter, which is said to happen to drunkards. The first glass sticks in the throat, the second flies down like a hawk, but after the third they're like tiny little birds. When Levin had changed his first 100-ruble note to pay for liveries for his footman and hall porter, he couldn't help reflecting that these liveries were of no use to anyone. But they were indubitably necessary, to judge by the amazement of the princess and Kitty, when he suggested that they might do without liveries, that these liveries would cost the wages of 2 labourers for the summer, that is, would pay for about 300 working days from Easter to Advent, and each a day of hard work from early morning to late evening. And that 100-ruble note did stick in his throat. But the next note, changed to pay for providing a dinner for their relations, which cost 28 rubles, though it did excite in Levin the reflection that 28 rubles meant about 72 bushels of oats, which men would, with groans and sweat, have reaped and bound and thrashed and winnowed and sifted and sown, this next one he parted with more easily. And now the notes he changed no longer aroused such reflections, and they flew off like little birds. Whether the labour devoted to obtaining the money corresponded to the pleasure given by what was bought with it was a consideration he had long ago dismissed. His business calculation that there was a certain price below which he couldn't sell certain grain was forgotten, too. The rye, for the price of which he had so long held out, had been sold for 50 kopecks a measure cheaper than it had been fetching a month ago. Even the consideration that with such an expenditure he couldn't go on living for a year without debt, even that had no force. Only one thing was essential: to have money in the bank without inquiring where it came from, so as to know that one had the wherewithal to buy meat for tomorrow. And this condition had hitherto been fulfilled. He had always had the money in the bank. But now the money in the bank had gone, and he couldn't quite tell where to get the next instalment. And this it was that at the moment when Kitty had mentioned money had disturbed him. But he had no time to think about it. He drove off, thinking of Katavasov and the meeting with Metrov that was before him. Chapter 3. Levin had, on this visit to town, seen a great deal of his old friend at the university, Professor Katavasov, whom he hadn't seen since his marriage. He liked in Katavasov the clarity and simplicity of his conception of life. Levin thought that the clarity of Katavasov's conception of life was due to the poverty of his nature. Katavasov thought that the disconnectedness of Levin's ideas was due to his lack of intellectual discipline, but Levin enjoyed Katavasov's clarity, and Katavasov enjoyed the abundance of Levin's untrained ideas, and they liked to meet and to discuss. Levin had read Katavasov some parts of his book, and he had liked them. On the previous day, Katavasov had met Levin at a public lecture and told him that the celebrated Metrov, whose article Levin had so much liked, was in Moscow, that he'd been much interested by what Katavasov had told him about Levin's work, and that he was coming to see him tomorrow at 11 and would be very glad to make Levin's acquaintance.
"You're positively a reformed character, I'm glad to see," said Katavasov, meeting Levin in the little drawing-room. "I heard the bell and thought, impossible that it can be he at the exact time. Well, what do you say to the Montenegrins now? Born fighters?"
"Why, what's happened?" asked Levin. Katavasov, in a few words, told him the last piece of news from the war, and going into his study, he introduced Levin to a short, thick-set man of pleasant appearance. This was Metrov. The conversation touched for a brief space on politics and how recent events were looked at in the higher spheres in Petersburg. Metrov repeated a saying that had reached him through a most trustworthy source, reported as having been uttered on this subject by the Tsar and one of the ministers. Katavasov had heard also on excellent authority that the Tsar had said something quite different. Levin tried to imagine circumstances in which both sayings might have been uttered, and the conversation on that topic dropped.
"Yes, here he's almost finished a book on the natural conditions of the labourer in relation to the land," said Katavasov. "I'm not a specialist, but I, as a natural science man, was pleased at his not taking mankind as something outside biological laws, but on the contrary, seeing his dependence on his surroundings, and in that dependence, seeking the laws of his development."
"That's very interesting," said Metrov.
"What I began precisely was to write a book on agriculture, but studying the chief instrument of agriculture, the labourer," said Levin, reddening. "I couldn't help coming to quite unexpected results." And Levin began carefully, as it were, feeling his ground, to expound his views. He knew Metrov had written an article against the general accepted theory of political economy, but to what extent he could count on his sympathy with his own new views, he didn't know, and couldn't guess from the clever and serene face of the learned man.
"But in what do you see the special characteristics of the Russian labourer?" said Metrov. "In his biological characteristics, so to speak, or in the condition in which he is placed?"
Levin saw that there was an idea underlying this question with which he didn't agree. But he went on explaining his own idea that the Russian labourer has a quite special view of the land, different from that of other people, and to support this proposition, he made haste to add that in his opinion, this attitude of the Russian peasant was due to the consciousness of his predicament in peopling vast, unoccupied expanses in the East.
"One may easily be led into error in basing any conclusion on the general vocation of a people," said Metrov, interrupting Levin. "The condition of the labourer will always depend on his relation to the land and to capital."
And without letting Levin finish explaining his idea, Metrov began expounding to him the special point of his own theory. In what the point of his theory lay, Levin didn't understand, because he didn't take the trouble to understand. He saw that Metrov, like other people, in spite of his own article in which he had attacked the current theory of political economy, looked at the position of the Russian peasant simply from the point of view of capital, wages, and rent. He would indeed have been obliged to admit that in the eastern, much larger part of Russia, rent was as yet nil, that for 9/10 of the 80 million Russian peasants, wages took the form simply of food provided for themselves, and that capital doesn't so far exist except in the form of the most primitive tools. Yet it was only from that point of view that he considered every labourer, though in many points he differed from the economists, and had his own new theory of wages which he expounded to Levin. Levin listened reluctantly, and at first made objections. He would have liked to interrupt Metrov, to explain his own thought, which in his opinion would have rendered further exposition of Metrov's theories superfluous. But later on, feeling convinced that they looked at the matter so differently that they could never understand one another, he didn't even oppose his statements, but simply listened. Although what Metrov was saying was by now utterly devoid of interest for him, he yet experienced a certain satisfaction in listening to him. It flattered his vanity that such a learned man should explain his ideas to him so eagerly, so painstakingly, and with such confidence in Levin's understanding of the subject, sometimes with a mere hint referring him to a whole aspect of the subject. He put this down to his own credit, unaware that Metrov, who had already discussed his theory over and over again with all his intimate friends, talked of it with special eagerness to every new person, and in general was eager to talk to anyone on any subject that interested him, even if still obscure to himself.
"We are late, though," said Katavasov, looking at his watch as soon as Metrov had finished his discourse. "Yes, there's a meeting of the Society of Amateurs today, in commemoration of the Jubilee of Svintish," said Katavasov, in answer to Levin's inquiry. "Pyotr Ivanovich and I were going. I promised to deliver an address on his works in zoology. Come along with us. It's very interesting." "Yes, and indeed it's time to start," said Metrov. "Come with us, and from there, if you care to, come to my place. I should very much like to hear your work."
"Oh, no, it's no good yet. It's unfinished. But I shall be very glad to go to the meeting."
"I say, friends, have you heard?
"He's handed in his resolution," Katavasov called from the other room where he was putting on his frock coat. And a conversation sprang up about a university problem. That university problem was a very important event that winter in Moscow. Three old professors in the council had not accepted the opinion of the younger professors. The young ones had registered a separate resolution. This, in the judgment of some people, was monstrous. In the judgment of others, it was the simplest and most just thing to do, and the professors were split up into two parties. One party, to which Katavasov belonged, saw in the opposite party a betrayal and gross treachery, while the opposite party saw in them youthful impudence and lack of respect for the authorities. Levin, though he didn't belong to the university, had several times already, during his stay in Moscow, heard and talked about this matter, and had his own opinion on the subject. He took part in the conversation that was continued in the street as they all three walked to the buildings of the old university. The meeting had already begun. Around the cloth-covered table at which Katavasov and Metrov seated themselves, there were six persons, and one of these was bending close over a manuscript, reading something aloud. Levin sat down in one of the empty chairs that were standing around the table, and in a whisper asked a student sitting near what was being read. The student, eyeing Levin with displeasure, said, "Biography." Though Levin wasn't interested in the biography, he couldn't help listening, and learned some new and interesting facts about the life of the distinguished man of science. When the reader had finished, the chairman thanked him, and read some verses the poet Mont had written in honour of the Jubilee, and said a few words by way of thanks to the poet. Then Katavasov, in his loud, ringing voice, read his address on the scientific works of the man whose Jubilee it was. When Katavasov had finished, Levin looked at his watch, saw it was past one, and thought that there wouldn't be time before the concert to read Metrov his book, and indeed he didn't now care to do so. During the reading he had thought over their conversation. He saw distinctly now that though Metrov's ideas might perhaps have value, his own ideas had value too, and their ideas could be made clear and lead to something only if each worked separately in his chosen path, and that nothing would be gained by putting their ideas together. And having made up his mind to refuse Metrov's invitation, Levin went up to him at the end of the meeting. Metrov introduced Levin to the chairman, with whom he was talking of the political news. Metrov told the chairman what he had already told Levin, and Levin made the same remarks that he had already made that morning, but for the sake of variety he expressed also a new opinion which had only just struck him. After that, the conversation turned again on the university question. As Levin had already heard it all, he made haste to tell Metrov that he was sorry he couldn't take advantage of his invitation, took leave, and drove to Ulvov's. Chapter 4. Ulvov, the husband of Natalie, Kitty's sister, had spent all his life in foreign capitals, where he had been educated, and had been in the diplomatic service. During the previous year he had left the diplomatic service, not owing to any unpleasantness — he never had any unpleasantness with anyone — and took a position in the Ministry of the Court in Moscow, in order to give his two boys the best education possible. In spite of the striking contrast in their habits and views, and the fact that Ulvov was older than Levin, they had seen a great deal of one another that winter, and had taken a great liking to each other. Ulvov was at home, and Levin went into him unannounced. Ulvov, wearing an indoor jacket with a belt and chamois leather slippers, was sitting in an armchair, and with a pince-nez with blue lenses he was reading a book that stood on a reading desk, while in his shapely hand he held a half-burned cigar daintily away from him. His handsome, delicate, and still youthful-looking face, to which his wavy, glistening, silvery hair gave a still more aristocratic air, lighted up with a smile when he saw Levin. "Marvellous! I was meaning to send to you. How's Kitty? Sit here. It's more comfortable." He got up and pushed forward a rocking chair. "Have you read the last circular in the Journal de Saint-Pétersbourg?" "I think it's excellent," he said, with a slight French accent. Levin told him that what he had heard from Katavasov was being said in Petersburg, and after talking a little about politics, he told him of his interview with Metrov and the Learned Society's meeting. To Lvov, it was very interesting.
"That's what I envy you, that you're able to mix in these interesting scientific circles," he said. And as he talked, he passed as usual into French, which was easier for him. "It's true, I haven't the time for it. My official work and the children leave me no time. And then I'm not ashamed to admit that my education has been too defective."
"That I don't believe," said Levin with a smile, feeling, as he always did, touched at Lvov's low opinion of himself, which was not in the least put on from a desire to seem or to be modest, but was absolutely sincere.
"Oh, yes, absolutely. I feel now how badly educated I am. To educate my children, I positively have to look up a great deal, and in fact simply to study myself. For it's not enough to have teachers. There must be someone to look after them, just as on your land you want labourers and an overseer. See what I'm reading?" He pointed to Buslaev's grammar on the desk. "It's expected of Misha, and it's so difficult. Come, explain to me. Here, he says."
Levin tried to explain to him that it couldn't be understood, but that it had to be taught. But Lvov wouldn't agree with him.
"Oh, you're laughing at me." "On the contrary, you can't imagine how, when I look at you, I'm always learning the task that lies before me. That is, the education of one's children."
"Well, there's nothing for you to learn," said Lvov.
"All I know," said Levin, "is that I've never seen better brought-up children than yours, and I wouldn't wish for children better than yours."
Lvov visibly tried to restrain the expression of his delight, but he was positively radiant with smiles.
"If only they're better than me, that's all I desire."
"You don't know yet all the work," he said, "with boys who've been left, like mine, to run wild abroad."
"They'll catch up. They're such clever children. The great thing is moral training. That's what I learn when I look at your children."
"You talk of moral training. You can't imagine how difficult that is."
"You have hardly succeeded in combating one tendency when others crop up, and the struggle begins again. If one had not a support in religion, you remember we talked about that, no father could bring children up relying on his own strength alone without that help."
This subject, which always interested Levin, was cut short by the entrance of the beautiful Natalie Alexandrovna, dressed to go out.
"I didn't know you were here," she said,
obviously feeling no regret but a positive pleasure in interrupting this conversation on a topic she had heard so much of that she was by now weary of it.
"Well, how is Kitty?"
"I'm dining with you today."
"I tell you what, Asyeni," she turned to her husband, "you take the carriage."
And the husband and wife began to discuss their arrangements for the day. As the husband had to drive to meet someone on official business, while the wife had to go to the concert and some public meeting of the Southeastern Committee, there was a great deal to consider and settle. Levin had to take part in their plans as one of them. It was settled that Levin should go with Natalie to the concert and the meeting, and that from there they should send the carriage to the office for Asyeni, and he should call for her and take her to Kitty's, or that if he had not finished his work, he should send the carriage back and Levin would go with her.
"He's spoiling me," Lvov said to his wife.
"Asyeni goes to extremes," said his wife.
"He assures me that our children are perfect, when I know that they have many defects. If you look for perfection, you'll never be satisfied."
"And it's true, as Papa says, that when we were brought up, there was one extreme. We were kept in the attic, while our parents lived in the best rooms. Now it's just the other way. The parents are in the storeroom, while the children are on the first floor."
"Parents now are not expected to live at all, but to exist altogether for their children."
"Well, what if they like it better?"
Lvov said, with his beautiful smile touching her hand.
"Anyone who didn't know you would think you were a stepmother, not a true mother."
"No,
extremes are not good in anything," Natalie said serenely, putting his paper knife straight in its proper place on the table.
"Well, come here, you perfect children," Lvov said to the two handsome boys who came in, and after bowing to Levin, went up to their father, obviously wishing to ask him about something. Levin would have liked to talk to them, to hear what they would say to their father, but Natalie began talking to him, and then Lvov's colleague in the service, Makhotin, walked in, wearing his court uniform, to go with him to meet someone, and a conversation was kept up without a break upon Herzegovina, Princess Korzinskaya, the town council, and the sudden death of Madame Apratskina. Levin even forgot the commission entrusted to him. He recollected it as he was going into the hall. "Oh, Kitty told me to talk to you about Oblonsky," he said, as Lvov was standing on the stairs, seeing his wife and Levin off. "Yes, yes. Maman wants us, les beaux frères, to attack him," he said, blushing. "But why should I?" "Well, then, I'll attack him," said Madame Uvova, with a smile, standing in her white fur cape, waiting till they'd finished speaking. "Come, let us go." Chapter 5. At the concert in the afternoon, two very interesting works were performed. One was a fantasia, King Lear in the steppe. The other was a quartet dedicated to the memory of Bach. Both were new and in the modern style, and Levin was eager to form an opinion of them. After escorting his sister-in-law to her stall, he stood against a column and tried to listen as attentively and conscientiously as possible. He tried not to let his attention be distracted, and not to spoil his impression by looking at the conductor in a white tie, waving his arms, which always disturbed his enjoyment of music so much, or the ladies in bonnets with strings carefully tied over their ears. And all these people, either thinking of nothing at all, or thinking of all sorts of things except the music. He tried to avoid meeting music connoisseurs or talkative acquaintances, and stood looking at the floor straight before him, listening. But the more he listened to the King Lear fantasia, the further he felt from forming any definite opinion on it. There seemed to be a continual beginning, a preparation for the musical expression of some feeling, but it fell to pieces again, immediately, breaking into new expressions of emotions, or simply into nothing but the whims of the composer, exceedingly complex but disconnected sounds. And these fragmentary musical expressions, though sometimes beautiful, were unpleasant, because they were utterly unexpected and not prepared for by anything. Gaiety and grief and despair and tenderness and triumph followed one another without any connection, like the emotions of a madman. And those emotions, like a madman's, sprang up quite unexpectedly. During the whole of the performance, Levin felt like a deaf man watching people dancing, and was in a state of complete bewilderment when the fantasia was over, and felt a great weariness from the fruitless strain on his attention. Loud applause resounded on all sides. Everyone got up, moved about, and began talking. Anxious to throw some light on his own perplexity from the impressions of others, Levin began to walk about, looking for connoisseurs, and was glad to see a well-known connoisseur in conversation with Pestsov, whom he knew. "Marvellous," Pestsov was saying in his mellow bass. "How are you, Konstantin Dmitrievich?" "Particularly graphic and sculpturesque, so to say. And richly coloured is that passage where you feel Cordelia's approach, where woman, das ewig weibliche, enters into conflict with fate. Isn't it?"
"You mean..."
"What had Cordelia to do with it?" Levin asked timidly, forgetting that the fantasia was supposed to represent King Lear.
"Cordelia comes in. See, here," said Pestsov, tapping his finger on the satiny surface of the programme he held in his hand, and passing it to Levin.
Only then did Levin recollect the title of the fantasia, and made haste to read in the Russian translation the lines from Shakespeare that were printed on the back of the programme.
"You can't follow it without that," said Pestsov, addressing Levin, because the person he had been speaking to had gone away, and he had no one to talk to.
In the entr'acte, Levin and Pestsov fell into an argument about the merits and defects of the Wagner school of music.
Levin maintained that the mistake of Wagner and all his followers lay in their trying to take music into the sphere of another art, just as poetry goes wrong when it tries to paint a face, which is what should be left to painting. And, as an instance of this mistake, he cited the sculptor who carved in marble certain shadows of poetical images flitting around the figure of the poet on the pedestal.
"These shadows were so far from being shadows that they were positively clinging to the ladder," said Levin.
The comparison pleased him, but he couldn't remember whether or not he had used the same phrase before, and to Pestsov, too, and as he said it, he felt embarrassed. Pestsov maintained that art is one, and that it can attain its highest manifestations only in conjunction with all kinds of art. The second piece that was performed, Levin couldn't hear. Pestsov, who was standing beside him, was talking to him almost all the time, condemning the music for its excessive, affected assumption of simplicity, and comparing it with the simplicity of the Pre-Raphaelites in painting. As he went out, Levin met many more acquaintances, with whom he talked of politics, of music, and of common acquaintances. Among others, he met Count Boll, whom he had utterly forgotten to call upon.
"Well, go at once, then," Madame Lvova said when he told her. "Perhaps they'll not be at home, and then you can come to the meeting to fetch me. You'll find me still there."
Chapter 6
"Perhaps they're not at home," said Levin as he went into the hall of Countess Boll's house. "Yes, they are," said the porter, resolutely removing his overcoat. "How annoying," thought Levin with a sigh, taking off one glove and smoothing his hat. "What did I come for? What have I to say to them?"
As he passed through the first drawing room, Levin met Countess Boll in the doorway. She was giving some order to a servant with a careworn and severe face. On seeing Levin, she smiled and asked him to come into the little drawing room, where he heard voices. In this room, sitting in armchairs, were the two daughters of the Countess, and a Moscow colonel whom Levin knew. Levin went up, greeted them, and sat down beside the sofa with his hat on his knees.
"How is your wife? Have you been at the concert?" "We couldn't go. Mama had to be at the funeral service."
"Yes, I heard." "What a sudden death," said Levin.
The Countess came in, sat down on the sofa, and she, too, asked after his wife and inquired about the concert. Levin answered, and repeated an inquiry about Madame Apraxina's sudden death.
"But she was always in weak health."
"Were you at the opera yesterday?"
"Yes, I was."
"Luka was very good."
"Yes, very good," he said.
And as it was utterly of no consequence to him what they thought of him, he began repeating what they had heard 100 times about the characteristics of the singer's talent. Countess Boll pretended to be listening. Then, when he had said enough and paused, the colonel, who'd been silent till then, began to talk. The colonel, too, talked of the opera and about culture. At last, after speaking of the proposed folle journée at Turin's, the colonel laughed, got up noisily, and went away. Levin, too, rose, but he saw by the face of the Countess that it was not yet time for him to go. He must stay 2 minutes longer. He sat down. But as he was thinking all the while how stupid it was, he couldn't find a subject for conversation, and sat silent.
"You're not going to the public meeting? They say it will be very interesting," the Countess began. "No, I promised my belle-sœur to fetch her there," said Levin.
A silence followed. The mother once more exchanged glances with her daughter.
"Well, now I think the time has come," thought Levin, and he got up. The lady shook hands with him and begged him to say mille choses to his wife for them.
The porter asked him, as he gave him his fur coat, "Where is your honour staying?" and immediately wrote down his address in a big, handsomely bound book.
"Of course I don't care, but still I feel ashamed and awfully stupid," thought Levin, consoling himself with the reflection that everyone does it.
He drove to the public meeting where he was to find his sister-in-law so as to drive home with her. At the public meeting of the committee, There were a great many people, and almost all the highest society. Levin was in time for the report, which, as everyone said, was very interesting. When the reading of the report was over, people moved about, and Levin met Shavasky, who invited him very pressingly to come that evening to a meeting of the Society of Agriculture, where a celebrated lecture was to be delivered, and Stepan Arkadyevich, who'd only just come from the races, and many other acquaintances. And Levin heard and uttered various criticisms on the meeting, on the new fantasia, and on a public trial. But probably from the mental fatigue he was beginning to feel, he made a blunder in speaking of the trial, and this blunder he recalled several times with vexation. Speaking of the sentence upon a foreigner who'd been condemned in Russia, and of how unfair it would be to punish him by exile abroad, Levin repeated what he had heard the day before in conversation with an acquaintance.
"I think sending him abroad is much the same as punishing a pike by throwing it into the water," said Levin.
Then he recollected that this idea, which he had heard from an acquaintance and uttered as his own, came from a fable of Krylov's, and that the acquaintance had picked it up from a newspaper article. After driving home with his sister-in-law, and finding Kitty in good spirits and quite well, Levin drove to the club. Chapter 7 Levin reached the club just at the right time. Members and visitors were driving up as he arrived. Levin hadn't been at the club for a very long while, not since he lived in Moscow, when he was leaving the university and going into society. He remembered the club, the external details of its arrangement, but he had completely forgotten the impression it made on him in the old days. But as soon as, driving into the wide semicircular court and getting out of the sleigh, he mounted the steps, and the hall porter, wearing a shoulder belt, noiselessly opened the door to him with a bow, as soon as he saw in the porter's rooms the cloaks and galoshes of members who thought it less trouble to take them off downstairs, as soon as he heard the mysterious ringing bell that preceded him as he ascended the shallow, carpeted staircase, and saw the statue on the landing, and the third porter at the top doors, a familiar figure grown older, in the club livery, opening the door without haste or delay, and scanning the visitors as they passed in, Levin felt the old impression of the club come back in a rush, an impression of repose, comfort, and propriety.
"Your hat, please," the porter said to Levin, who forgot the club rule to leave his hat in the porter's room. "Long time since you've been. The prince put your name down yesterday. Prince Stepan Arkadyevich isn't here yet."
The porter didn't only know Levin, but also all his ties and relationships, and so immediately mentioned his intimate friends. Passing through the outer hall, divided up by screens, and the room partitioned on the right where there was a fruit buffet, Levin overtook an old man walking slowly in, and entered the dining room full of noise and people. He walked past the tables, almost all full, and looked at the visitors. He saw people of all sorts, old and young, some he knew a little, some were intimate friends. There was not a single cross or worried-looking face. All seemed to have left their cares and anxieties in the porter's room with their hats, and all were deliberately getting ready to enjoy the material blessings of life. Shavasky was here, and Shchebatsky, Nevedovsky, and the old prince, and Vronsky, and Sergei Ivanovitch.
"Ah, why are you late?" the prince said, smiling and giving him his hand over his own shoulder. "How's Kitty?" he added, smoothing out the napkin he had tucked behind a vest button. "All right. They're dining at home, all three of them." "Ah, Alinya and Nadinya, to be sure. There's no room with us."
"Go to that table and hurry up and take a seat," said the prince.
And turning away, he carefully took a plate of turbot soup.
"Levin, this way,"
a good-natured voice shouted a little further on. It was Turovtsin. He was sitting with a young officer, and beside them were two chairs turned upside down. Levin gladly went up to them. He'd always liked the good-hearted rake Turovtsin. He was associated in his mind with memories of his courtship, and at that moment, after the strain of intellectual conversation, the sight of Turovtsin's good-natured face was particularly welcome.
"For you and Oblodsky. He'll be here directly."
The young man, holding himself very erect, with eyes forever twinkling with enjoyment, was an officer from Petersburg, Gagin. Turovtsin introduced them.
Oblonsky's always late. Ah, here he is. Have you only just come? Said Oblonsky, coming quickly toward them. Hello, had some vodka? Well, come along then.
Levin got up and went with him to the big table spread with vodkas and appetizers of the most various kinds. One would have thought that out of 24 delicacies, one might find something to one's taste, but Stepan Arkadyevitch asked for something special, and one of the liveried waiters standing by immediately brought what was required. They drank a glassful and returned to their table. At once, while they were still on their soup, Gagin was served with champagne and told the waiter to fill 4 glasses. Levin didn't refuse the wine and asked for a second bottle. He was very hungry and ate and drank with great enjoyment. And with still greater enjoyment, he took part in the lively and simple conversation of his companions. Gagin, dropping his voice, told the last good story from Petersburg, and the story, though indecent and stupid, was so funny that Levin broke into roars of laughter so loud that those near looked around.
"That's the same as a 'that's just what I can't bear' story. You know the story?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "Ah, that's exquisite. Another bottle," he said to the waiter,
and he began to relate his good story.
"Pyotr Ilyich Vinovsky invites you to drink with him."
A little old waiter interrupted Stepan Arkadyevitch, bringing 2 delicate glasses of sparkling champagne and addressing Stepan Arkadyevitch and Levin. Stepan Arkadyevitch took the glass, and looking toward a bald man with red moustaches at the other end of the table, nodded to him, smiling. "Who's that?" asked Levin.
"You met him once at my place, don't you remember? A good-natured fellow."
Levin did the same as Stepan Arkadyevitch and took the glass. Stepan Arkadyevitch's anecdote, too, was very amusing. Levin told his story, and that, too, was successful. Then they talked of horses, of the races, of what they'd been doing that day, and of how skilfully Vronsky's Atlas had won the first prize. Levin didn't notice how the time passed at dinner.
"Ah, and here they are," Stepan Arkadyevitch said toward the end of dinner, leaning over the back of his chair and holding out his hand to Vronsky, who came up with the tall officer of the guards.
Vronsky's face, too, beamed with the look of good-humoured enjoyment that was general in the club. He propped his elbow playfully on Stepan Arkadyevitch's shoulder, whispering something to him, and he held out his hand to Levin with the same good-humoured smile.
"Very glad to meet you," he said. "I looked for you at the election, but I was told you'd gone away." "Yes, I left the same day. We've just been talking of your horse." "I congratulate you," said Levin. "It was very well run." "You've racehorses too, haven't you?"
"No.
My father had, but I remember and know something about it." "Where have you dined?" asked Stepan Arkadyevitch. "We were at the second table, behind the columns."
"We've been celebrating his success," said the tall colonel. "It's his second imperial prize. I wish I might have the luck at cards he has with horses. Well, why waste the precious time? I'm going to the infernal regions," added the colonel, and he walked away.
"That's Yashvin," Vronsky said in answer to Turovtsin, and he sat down in the vacated seat beside them. He drank the glass offered him and ordered a bottle of wine. Under the influence of the club atmosphere, or the wine he had drunk, Levin chattered away to Vronsky of the best breeds of cattle, and was very glad not to feel the slightest hostility to this man. He even told him, among other things, that he had heard from his wife that she had met him at Princess Maria Borisovna's.
"Ah, Princess Maria Borisovna, she's exquisite," said Stepan Arkadyevitch,
and he told an anecdote about her which set them all laughing. Vronsky particularly laughed with such simple-hearted amusement that Levin felt quite reconciled to him.
"Well, have we finished?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch, getting up with a smile. "Let us go!"
Chapter 8 Getting up from the table, Levin walked with Gagin through the lofty room to the billiard room, feeling his arms swing as he walked with a peculiar lightness and ease. As he crossed the big room, he came upon his father-in-law.
"Well, how do you like our Temple of Indolence?" said the prince, taking his arm. "Come along, come along."
"Yes.
I wanted to walk about and look at everything.
It's interesting.
Yes, it's interesting for you, but its interest for me is quite different. You look at those little old men now, he said, pointing to a club member with bent back and projecting lip, shuffling toward them in his soft boots. And imagine that they were schlupiks like that from their birth up.
How schlupiks?
I see you don't know that name. That's our club designation. You know the game of rolling eggs. When one's rolled a long while, it becomes a schlupik. So it is with us. One goes on coming and coming to the club, and ends up by becoming a schlupik. Ah, you laugh. But we look out for fear of dropping into it ourselves. You know Prince Chechensky?
Inquired the prince, and Levin saw by his face that he was just going to relate something funny. No, I don't know him.
You don't say so. Well, Prince Chechensky is a well-known figure. No matter, though. He's always playing billiards here. Only 3 years ago he was not a schlupik, and kept up his spirits, and even used to call other people schlupiks. But one day he turns up, and our porter... You know Vasily. Why, that fat one. He's famous for his bon mots. And so Prince Chechensky asks him, Come, Vasily, who's here? Any schlupiks here yet? And he says, You're the third. Yes, my dear boy, that he did.
Talking and greeting the friends they met, Levin and the prince walked through all the rooms, the great room where tables had already been set and the usual partners were playing for small stakes, the divan room where they were playing chess and Sergei Ivanovich was sitting talking to somebody, the billiard room where, about a sofa in a recess, there was a lively party drinking champagne. Gagin was one of them. They peeped into the infernal regions, where a good many men were crowding around one table at which Yashvin was sitting. Trying not to make any noise, they walked into the dimly lighted reading room, where under the shaded lamps there sat a young man with a wrathful countenance, turning over one journal after another, and a bald general buried in a book. They went, too, into what the prince called the intellectual room, where three gentlemen were engaged in a heated discussion of the latest political news.
"Prince, please come. We're ready," said one of his card party, who had come to look for him,
and the prince went off. Levin sat down and listened, but recalling the conversation of the morning, all of a sudden he felt terribly bored. He got up hurriedly and went to look for Oblonsky and Turovtsin, with whom it had been so pleasant. Turovtsin was one of the circle drinking in the billiard room, and Stepan Arkadyevitch was talking with Vronsky near the door, at the further corner of the room.
"It's not that she's bored, but this undefined, this unsettled situation," Levin caught,
and he was hurrying away, but Stepan Arkadyevitch called to him.
"Levin," said Stepan Arkadyevitch,
and Levin noticed that his eyes were not full of tears exactly, but moist, which always happened when he had been drinking, or when he was touched. Just now it was due to both causes.
"Levin, don't go," he said,
and he warmly squeezed his arm above the elbow, obviously not at all wishing to let him go.
"This is a true friend of mine, almost my greatest friend," he said to Vronsky. "You have become even closer and dearer to me. And I want you to, and I know you should be friends and great friends, because you're both splendid fellows. Well, there's nothing for us now but to kiss and be friends," Vronsky said with good-natured playfulness, holding out his hand.
Levin quickly took the offered hand and pressed it warmly.
"I'm very, very glad," said Levin. "Waiter, a bottle of champagne," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "And I'm very glad," said Vronsky.
But in spite of Stepan Arkadyevitch's desire and their own desire, they had nothing to talk about, and both felt it.
"Do you know, he's never met Anna," Stepan Arkadyevitch said to Vronsky. "And I want more than anything to take him to see her. Let's go, Levin."
"Really?" said Vronsky.
"She'll be very glad to see you. I should be going home at once," he added. "But I'm worried about Yashvin, and I want to stay till he finishes." "Why, is he losing?" "He keeps losing, and I'm the only friend that can restrain him." "Well, what do you say to a pyramid? Levin, will you play?" "Fine," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "Get the pyramid ready," he said to the marker. "It has been a long time," answered the marker,
who had already set the balls in a triangle,
and was knocking the red one about for his own diversion.
Well, let's begin.
After the game, Vronsky and Levin sat down at Gagin's table, and at Stepan Arkadyevich's suggestion, Levin took a hand in the game. Vronsky sat down at the table, surrounded by friends, who were incessantly coming up to him. Every now and then he went to the Infernal to keep an eye on Yashvin. Levin was enjoying a delightful sense of repose after the mental fatigue of the morning. He was glad that all hostility was at an end with Vronsky, and the sense of peace, decorum, and comfort never left him. When the game was over, Stepan Arkadyevich took Levin's arm.
"Well, let's go to Anna's, then. At once, eh? She's at home. I promised her long ago to bring you. Where were you meaning to spend the evening?" "Oh, nowhere specially. I promised Chavasky to go to the Society of Agriculture." "By all means, let's go," said Levin. "Very good. Come along. Find out if my carriage is here," Stepan Arkadyevich said to the waiter.
Levin went up to the table, paid the 40 rubles he had lost, paid his bill, the amount of which was in some mysterious way ascertained by the little old waiter who stood at the counter, and swinging his arms, he walked through all the rooms to the way out. Chapter 9
"The Oblonsky carriage," the porter shouted in a loud bass.
The carriage drove up, and both got in. It was only for the first few moments, while the carriage was still in the courtyard, that Levin was still under the influence of the club atmosphere of repose, comfort, and unimpeachable good form. But as soon as the carriage drove out into the street, and he felt it jolting over the uneven cobbled road, heard the angry shout of a sleigh driver coming toward them, saw in the uncertain light the red signboard of a tavern and the shops, this impression was dissipated, and he began to think over his actions, and to wonder whether he was doing the right thing in going to see Anna. What would Kitty say? But Stepan Arkadyevich gave him no time for reflection, and as though divining his thoughts, he scattered them.
"How glad I am," he said, "that you should know her. You know Dolly has long wished for it, and Lvov's been to see her, and often goes. Even though she's my sister," Stepan Arkadyevich pursued, "I don't hesitate to say that she's a remarkable woman. But you will see. Her position is very painful, especially now."
"Why especially now?"
"We're carrying on negotiations with her husband about a divorce, and he's agreed. But there are difficulties in regard to the son, and the business, which ought to have been arranged long ago, has been dragging on for 3 months now. As soon as the divorce is over, she'll marry Vronsky." "How stupid that old ceremony is, walking round and round and singing, 'Rejoice, O Isaiah,' that no one believes in, and that stands in the way of the happiness of people," Stepan Arkadyevich put in. "Well, then their situation will be as regular as mine, as yours."
"What's the difficulty?" said Levin.
"Oh, it's a long and tedious story. The whole business is such an anomaly in this country. But the point is, she's been in Moscow for 3 months, where everyone knows her, waiting for the divorce. She goes out nowhere, sees no woman except Dolly, because, you understand, she doesn't care to have people come as a favour. That fool Princess Varvara, even she has left her, considering this a breach of propriety. Well, you see, in such a position any other woman would not have found resources in herself. But you'll see how she's arranged her life, how calm, how dignified she is." "To the left, in the lane opposite the church," shouted Stepan Arkadyevich, leaning out of the window. "Phew, how hot it is," he said, in spite of the 27-degree temperature, flinging his unbuttoned overcoat still wider open. "But she has a daughter. No doubt she's busy looking after her," said Levin. "I believe you picture every woman simply as a female, une couveuse," said Stepan Arkadyevich. "If she's occupied, it must be with her children." "No. She brings her up very well, I believe, but one doesn't hear about her. She's busy, in the first place, with what she writes. I see you're smiling ironically, but you're wrong. She's writing a children's book, and doesn't talk about it to anyone. But she read it to me, and I gave the manuscript to Vokuyev, you know, the publisher. And he's an author himself, too, I think. He understands those things, and he says it's a remarkable piece of work. But are you imagining she's an authoress? Not at all. Above all, she's a woman with a heart. But you'll see. Now she has a little English girl with her, and a whole family she's looking after.
Oh, something in a philanthropic way?
Why, you will look at everything in the worst light. It's not from philanthropy, it's from the heart. They, that is, Vronsky, had a trainer, an Englishman, first-rate in his own line, but a drunkard. He's completely given up to drink. Delirium tremens. And the family was cast on the world. She saw them, helped them, got more and more interested in them, and now the whole family is on her hands. But not by way of patronage, you know. Helping with money. She's herself preparing the boys in Russian for the high school, and she's taken the little girl to live with her. But you'll see her for yourself.
The carriage drove into the courtyard, and Stepan Arkadyevitch rang loudly at the entrance where sleighs were standing. And without asking the servant who opened the door whether the lady was at home, Stepan Arkadyevitch walked into the hall. Levin followed him, more and more doubtful whether he was doing right or wrong. Looking at himself in the mirror, Levin noticed that he was red in the face, but he felt certain that he wasn't drunk, and he followed Stepan Arkadyevitch up the carpeted stairs. At the top, Stepan Arkadyevitch inquired of the footman, who bowed to him as to an intimate friend, who was with Anna Arkadyevna, and received the answer that it was Monsieur Vorkuyev.
"Where are they?"
"In the study."
Passing through the dining room, a room not very large, with dark panelled walls, Stepan Arkadyevitch and Levin walked over the soft carpet to the half-dark study, lighted up by a single lamp with a big dark shade. Another lamp, with a reflector, was hanging on the wall, lighting up a big, full-length portrait of a woman, which Levin couldn't help looking at. It was the portrait of Anna, painted in Italy by Mikhailov. While Stepan Arkadyevitch went behind the trellis, and the voice of the man who had been speaking paused, Levin gazed at the portrait, which stood out from the frame in the brilliant light thrown on it, and he couldn't tear himself away from it. He positively forgot where he was, and not even hearing what was said, he couldn't take his eyes off the marvellous portrait. It wasn't a picture, but a living, charming woman, with black curling hair, with bare arms and shoulders, with a pensive smile on lips covered with soft down. Triumphantly and softly she looked at him with eyes that baffled him. She wasn't alive, only because she was more beautiful than a living woman could be.
"I'm delighted."
He suddenly heard a voice near him unmistakably addressing him, the voice of the very woman he had been admiring in the portrait. Anna had come from behind the trellis to meet him, and Levin saw, in the dim light of the study, the very woman of the portrait, in a dark dress of various shades of blue, not in the same position nor with the same expression, but with the same perfection of beauty which the artist had caught in the portrait. She was less dazzling in reality, but on the other hand, there was something fresh and seductive in the living woman which wasn't in the portrait. Chapter 10. She had risen to meet him, not concealing her pleasure at seeing him, and in the quiet ease with which she held out her little energetic hand, introduced him to Vorkuyev, and indicated a red-haired, pretty little girl who was sitting at work, calling her her pupil, Levin recognized and liked the manners of a woman of the world, always self-possessed and natural.
"I'm delighted,
delighted," she repeated. And on her lips, these simple words held for Levin's ears a special significance. "I've known you and liked you for a long while, both from your friendship with Stiva and for your wife's sake. I knew her for a very short time. But she left on me the impression of an exquisite flower, simply a flower. And to think she'll soon be a mother." She spoke easily and without haste, looking now and then from Levin to her brother. And Levin felt that the impression he was making was good, and he felt immediately at home, simple and happy with her, as though he had known her from childhood. "Ivan Petrovitch and I settled in Alexei's study," she said, in answer to Stepan Arkadyevitch's question whether he might smoke, just so as to be able to smoke. And glancing at Levin, instead of asking whether he would care to smoke,
She pulled closer a tortoise-shell cigarette case and took a cigarette.
"How are you feeling today?"
her brother asked her.
"Oh, nothing. Nerves as usual." "Yes, isn't it extraordinarily fine?"
said Stepan Arkadyevitch, noticing that Levin was scrutinizing the picture. "I've never seen a better portrait."
"An extraordinary likeness, isn't it?" said Vorkuyev.
Levin looked from the portrait to the original. A peculiar brilliance lighted up Anna's face when she felt his eyes on her. Levin flushed, and to cover his embarrassment, was about to ask whether she had seen Darya Alexandrovna lately. But at that moment Anna spoke.
"We were just talking, Ivan Petrovitch and I, of Vashenkov's last pictures. Have you seen them?"
"Yes, I've seen them," Levin answered.
"But I beg your pardon. I interrupted you. You were saying?"
Levin asked if she'd seen Dolly lately.
"She was here yesterday. She was very indignant with the high school people on Grisha's account. The Latin teacher, it seems, has been unfair to him."
"Yes, I've seen his pictures. I didn't care for them very much," Levin said, going back to the subject she had started. Levin talked now not at all with that purely businesslike attitude toward the subject with which he had been talking all morning. Every word in his conversation with her had a special significance, and talking to her was pleasant. Still pleasanter it was to listen to her. Anna talked not merely naturally and cleverly, but cleverly and casually, attaching no value to her own ideas, and giving great weight to the ideas of the person she was talking to. The conversation turned on the new movement in art, on the new illustrations of the Bible by a French artist. Vorkuyev attacked the artist for a realism carried to the point of coarseness. Levin said that the French had carried conventionality in art further than anyone, and that consequently they see a great merit in the return to realism. In the very fact that they do not lie, they see poetry. Never had anything clever said by Levin given him so much pleasure as this remark. Anna's face lighted up at once, as at once she appreciated the thought. She laughed.
"I laugh," she said, "as one laughs when one sees a very striking likeness. What you said so perfectly describes French art now, painting and literature too. Indeed, Zola, Daudet. But perhaps it's always so, that men form their conceptions from imaginary conventional types, and then, all the combinations made, they are tired of the imaginary figures and begin to invent more natural, true figures."
"That's perfectly true," said Vorkuyev.
"So you've been at the club?" she said to her brother.
"Yes, yes, this is a woman," Levin thought,
forgetting himself and staring persistently at her lovely mobile face, which at that moment was all at once completely transformed. Levin didn't hear what she was talking of as she leaned over to her brother, but he was struck by the change of her expression. Her face, so beautiful a moment before in its repose, suddenly wore a look of strange curiosity, anger, and pride. But this lasted only an instant. She lowered her eyelids as though recollecting something.
"Oh, well, but that's of no interest to anyone," she said.
And she turned to the English girl.
"Please order tea in the drawing-room," she said in English.
The girl got up and went out.
"Well, how did she get through her examination?"
asked Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Splendidly. She's a very gifted child and has a sweet disposition."
"It will end in your loving her more than your own."
"There a man speaks. In love there's no more nor less. I love my daughter with one love, and her with another."
"I was just telling Anna Arkadyevna," said Vorkuyev, "that if she were to put 1/100th part of the energy she devotes to this English girl to the public question of the education of Russian children, she'd be doing a great and useful work."
"Yes, but I can't help it. I couldn't do it. Count Alexei Kirillovich urged me very much."
As she uttered the words "Count Alexei Kirillovich," she glanced with appealing timidity at Levin, and he unconsciously responded with a respectful and reassuring look.
"He urged me to take up the school in the village. I visited it several times. The children were very nice, but I couldn't feel drawn to the work.
You speak of energy. Energy rests upon love, and comes as it will. There's no forcing it. I took to this child. I couldn't myself say why. And she glanced again at Levin, and her smile and her glance all told him it was only to him that she was addressing her words, valuing his good opinion, and at the same time sure beforehand that they understood each other.
"I quite understand that," Levin answered. "It's impossible to give one's heart to a school or such institutions in general. And I believe that's just why philanthropic institutions always give such poor results."
She was silent for a while. Then she smiled.
"Yes, yes," she agreed. "I never could.
My heart isn't big enough to love a whole asylum of horrid little girls. I never could succeed with that. There are so many women who have made themselves a social position in that way." And now more than ever, she said, with a mournful, confiding expression, ostensibly addressing her brother, but unmistakably intending her words only for Levin. "Now, when I have such need of some occupation, I cannot." And suddenly frowning, Levin saw that she was frowning at herself for talking about herself, she changed the subject. "I know about you," she said to Levin, "that you're not a public-spirited citizen, and I've defended you to the best of my ability."
"How have you defended me?"
"Oh, according to the attacks made on you. But won't you have some tea?" She rose and took up a book bound in Morocco.
"Give it to me, Anna Arkadyevna," said Volkuyev, indicating the book. "It's well worth doing."
"Oh, no, it's all so sketchy."
"I told him about it," Stepan Arkadyevitch said to his sister, nodding at Levin.
"You shouldn't have.
My writing is something after the fashion of those fretwork baskets the prisoners made, which Liza Merkalova used to sell me. She was the chairman of the prison department in some society," she turned to Levin, "and they were miracles of patience, the work of those poor wretches."
And Levin saw a new trait in this woman who attracted him so extraordinarily. Besides wit, grace, and beauty, she had sincerity. She had no wish to hide from him all the bitterness of her position. As she said that, she sighed, and her face, suddenly taking a hard expression, looked as if it were turned to stone. With that expression on her face, she was more beautiful than ever. But the expression was new. It was utterly unlike that expression, radiant with happiness and creating happiness, which had been caught by the painter in her portrait. Levin looked more than once at the portrait and at her figure when, taking her brother's arm, she walked with him through the lofty doors, and he felt for her a tenderness and pity which surprised him. She asked Levin and Volkuyev to go into the drawing-room while she stayed behind to say a few words to her brother.
"About her divorce? About Vronsky and what he's doing at the club?"
"About me?" Levin wondered. And he was so keenly interested in what she was saying to Stepan Arkadyevitch that he scarcely heard what Volkuyev was telling him of the virtues of the children's story Anna Arkadyevna had written. At tea, the same pleasant sort of talk, full of interesting matter, continued. There wasn't a single instant when they had to look for a subject for conversation. On the contrary, one hardly had time to say what one had to say, and eagerly held back to hear what the others were saying. And all that was said, not only by her, but by Volkuyev and Stepan Arkadyevitch, all, so it seemed to Levin, gained peculiar significance from her appreciation and her observations. While he followed this interesting conversation, Levin was all the time admiring her, her beauty, her intelligence, her culture, and at the same time her directness and innate ability to convey her warmth. He listened and talked, and all the while he was thinking of her inner life, trying to divine her feelings. And though he had judged her so severely hitherto, now, by some strange chain of reasoning, he was justifying her, and also sorry for her, and afraid that Vronsky didn't fully understand her. At 11 o'clock, when Stepan Arkadyevitch got up to go, for Kuyev had left earlier, it seemed to Levin that he had only just come. Levin, regretfully, got up too. "Goodbye," she said, holding his hand and glancing into his face with a look that drew him to her. "I'm very glad that the ice is broken." She dropped his hand and screwed up her eyes.
Tell your wife that I love her as before, and that if she cannot pardon me my position, then my wish for her is that she may never pardon it. To pardon it, one must go through what I have gone through, and may God spare her that.
Certainly, yes, I will tell her,
Levin said, blushing.